Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Artist Rachel White-Reed has made casts and drawings for more than 30 years in an effort to define the space between positives and negatives, public and private, manufactured and handmade objects, always with concision, intelligence, beauty, and power. At the National Gallery of Art, an unprecedented and comprehensive survey exhibition of White-Reed's celebrated career introduces a new generation of audiences to her work, which addresses how we live. In this keynote address for the symposium, held on October 26, 2018, in conjunction with the exhibition, Mari Lending links cast sculptures by White-Reed with 19th century plaster monuments in theorizing ghost structures, which always refer to places and things absent, lost, or distant. She describes how White-Reed's work, once briefly installed in the cast courts of the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, invites us to look again at lost objects and to see them anew. Cast representations, Lending says, are complex and productive rather than simply reproductive.
I'm so delighted to be here today. Being Norwegian, I thought living in Oslo, I thought it could be nice to start by showing a recent shot of Rachel White-Reed's one Norwegian piece, namely the Gran Boathouse from 2010. I was there a couple of weeks ago with a group of students on a glorious sunny morning. This is a 1 hour and 15 minutes drive north of Oslo. This iPhone snapshot somehow looks as a contemporary, kitschy version of a 19th century Norwegian national romantic painting, with this concrete structure on the water in lieu of an ancient loft or a stave church. Hadeland, the county, Gran, the village, and Røykenviken, this bay on the so-called Ransfjorden, which is not a fjord, in fact, but a big lake, makes a landscape that feels strikingly ancient. And it is indeed charged with both history and legend. The king who ruled this territory in the first part of the 9th century is believed to have met his untimely death on this particular spot as he was crossing the frozen lake midwinter. His reign and sudden death continuously appeared in medieval documents the next centuries, including in the Icelandic bard and statesman Snorre's Norse king sagas from the 13th century. So what you see here is one of the Norwegian artist Erik Wernskiold's iconic illustrations of Snorre's saga from the 1890s of this incident that assumingly took place no more than 100 meters out on the water from the Gran Boathouse. When we were at the boathouse recently, another partly legendary, partly incredibly real reference emerged from the water, this time as if straight out of a fairy tale, namely the Ugly Duckling, as it is globally known. Autumn is, of course, high season for the ugly ducklings, when the adorable little baby swans from the early spring have grown bigger over summer. As my students were drawing and photographing the boathouse, a big white swan suddenly approached on high speed with two young swans tagging along. A moment after we noticed them, they jumped up among us. We all pulled back. Swans can be horrifyingly aggressive. However, this little ensemble was surprisingly friendly, and after one of the students offered them his lunch, they hung out with us for the rest of our stay. This was all very cute, but also interesting in regards of the material presence of the boathouse. The students, at the moment working on casting concrete in large-scale projects in school, were hypnotized, not only of the beauty of the cast structure on the lake, but by the differences in the effects of the concrete aggregate in the roof and in the walls, of how the mold, that is the former version of this boathouse, in this case a corrugated lead roof, the wooden construction and the paneled walls, has translated so differently into this new entity. Discussing patina and weathering in the unexpected company of these two beautiful ugly ducklings, shimmering in shades of grey as young concrete swans belonging to the concrete sculpture that is now part of their habitat, they somehow enhanced the effects of the surface of the sculpture. When we arrived, this little piece of driftwood with a rusty metal nail was lying on the roof. Somebody must have placed it there. I have no idea if there is any kind of local maintenance involved. Personally, I hope not. Here you see fresh moss under the cornice, adding to the site specificity of the work, as well as marking the seasons and the work of time. Obviously, that day, those two concrete-colored young swans sparked an extra poetic effect for free. They also made me think of something else. The Ugly Duckling was published by the Danish author H.C. Andersen's first volume of fairy tales from the early 1840s. From the first reviews onwards, it was conceived as an allegory, and that allegorical dimension has stuck to the story, rendering a freak that becomes a beauty all the way into its Disney adaptation. A different allegorical dimension is, however, at work here, I believe, and one that has everything to do with time and temporalities, with patina, weathering, with our awareness of place and of displacement. What happens when vernacular architecture and monuments appear elsewhere? And not least, what happens when buildings and spaces are translated in terms of material, in regards of their relationship to what we conventionally talk about as the original work? I will not try to overstretch the similarities between what I call plaster monuments and Rachel Whiteread's most architectural sculpture. The 19th century, partly enormous architectural casts I've been working on were all about presenting the real thing as close to the original work as possible and in positive form. Yet, as I will show by some specific additions from different collections, they post radically different suggestions as to what the original looked like, how it ought to look, or what it might have looked like. One lesson learned from the 19th century cast quartz, most of them long since destroyed, is that the representational level of these representations is both complex and productive, simply than rather reproductive. These issues were played out in the surfaces, in the patination of the full-scale building fragments, surfaces that harbored profound issues of history and historicity, and often involving theories about pristine states. The significance of the surface is something they share with Whiteread's architectural works. Although the latter behaves somehow differently by exposing the positive form of a negative space from an architectural structure, thus presenting a completely different version or perhaps an echo of the real thing, both the 19th century monuments and these contemporary casts in plaster or concrete always marks the presence of something that is absent, lost, or elsewhere. In fact, the first piece I published when I started working up, started contemplating these casts, I discussed them exactly as ghost structures. But as we know also from Whiteread's by now iconic work Ghost, the spectral qualities of demolished or ruined buildings have an incredible power and sometimes a lasting presence. And one thing that I can seminally conclude is a similar effect of my historical and Whiteread's contemporary casts is that they surely make us look differently at architecture, and that they change our perception and awareness of the original work, extinct or extant. They let us understand something not only about the dubious fiction of the original work, but more importantly, they allow us to see something that the original itself can never provide. I was thrilled when Molly in the spring invited me to talk about the plaster monuments in the context of Rachel Whiteread's work. I had seen the first iteration of this exhibition at Tate Britain in January, and the prospect of seeing this superb show on yet another venue was, of course, irresistible. I did, in fact, also see the Sensation exhibition at the Royal Academy in London in the fall of 1997, and I was mesmerized by the 100 spaces cast in translucent resin. I was as overwhelmed to see that piece again in the Divine Gallery at the Tate in January, and now to see it, the 25 spaces edition here. When I started working on the plaster monuments, I was excited to discover that Whiteread's work in plaster had appeared in two of the world's most important and still existing cast quartz. So let me add a little bit of context to those two spaces that were activated by these contemporary interventions in 2003 and 2007, respectively. When Room 101 landed in the East Court at the Victoria and Albert Museum, it found a temporary home in what was an absolute epicenter of 19th century cast culture. The two cast courts at the V&A was inaugurated as the Architectural Courts in 1873, masterminded by Henry Cole, the first director of what had been established as the South Kensington Museum 20 years earlier. This conglomerate of museums and schools already encompassed important cast collections, if mostly of small architectural fragments. Cole soon started commissioning new monuments, aiming at curating a global canon of full-scale reproductions. These imposing spaces were tailored to fit Trajan's column cut into sections, an incredible achievement of casting and engineering, under the skylit ceiling. The width of the galleries was dictated by the three arched west entrance of the cathedral at Santiago de Compostela in northern Spain. The cast of the Portico della Gloria soon changed the status of the cathedral also in situ, as it became a pilgrimage destination for an emerging tourist industry as well, after its installation in London. So to the right, you see it under construction in the East Court, which will reopen after years of restorations in a few weeks. Another noteworthy monument produced for this collection and long since destroyed. Here you see yet another image of the Architecture Courts as a construction site. Was the eastern gateway of the Great Stupa at Sankey. It was cast on-site by Lieutenant Henry Hardy Cole, a Royal Engineer working with the Archaeological Survey of India, on a mission to help fulfill his father's vision of a virtually boundless museum of monuments to be synced in time as part of the same global history and in space when installed in the galleries. The transportation of heavy and fragile plaster monuments was hardly less laborious than the moving of actual buildings. The planning, equipment, know-how, logistics, and shipping involved resembles the grand-scale archaeological missions conducted at the time. The painted illustration to the left documented the difficulties besetting the transportation of the raw materials through the Indian jungle from Calcutta to Sankey, and to the right, Lieutenant Cole with local workforce. The Buddhist monument traveled for more than 3 months. It sailed up the Suez Canal only months after its grand opening in November 1869, before being erected in London. So here to the right, you see one of the additions immediately made in London as displayed in Brussels. The most imposing cast in the West Court, where Room 101 was shown, is so big that it is easily overlooked. The central doorway of the San Petronio Basilica, cast in Bologna in the 1880s, used to frame the electrotype tradition of the baptistry doors from Florence until the gallery was recently rearranged during a major refurbishment. That first installation was itself a lesson in scale and spatial perception, the Bologna portal completely dwarfing Ghiberti's Gates of Paradise. When Untitled Domestic from 2002 was displayed in the Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh, it was shown in the Hall of Sculpture, a gallery designed as an inverted version of the cella of the Parthenon, with the frieze turned inwards, a bizarre inversion that makes a kind of twisted spatial frame that, most likely unconsciously, enhanced issues at stake in Whitehead's spatial inversions. The adjacent gallery, the Hall of Architecture, makes a phantasmagorical interpretation of the mausoleum at Halicarnassus, turned outside in, designed when this vanished totality was still an archaeological novelty. So what you see here is an installation shot from 1907, and to the right, in a corner, a convincingly patinated replica of a column from the same structure produced at the British Museum. While the V&A in London was incredibly inventive in the commissioning, casting, and thus invention of new monuments from across time and place, the Carnegie Collection, as most American museums, were more in the receiving end. Of obvious political and geopolitical reasons, the US hardly participated in archaeological expeditions and did not take part in the race for antiquities in the Mediterranean and the Middle East. Nonetheless, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York was in the 1890s establishing what was conceived as the most all-encompassing collection of monuments in the world, so grand that it would have even European scholars go, now I'm quoting, go to New York as they now go to Rome, Athens, or the other great centers of the study of art. As the curator from 1910, the director of the Met, put it in the early 1890s. The Metropolitan also set up a plaster workshop modeled after the Atelier de Moulage at the Louvre to produce serialized editions for American collections to avoid the expensive and difficult transatlantic shipping of monuments. Yet when Andrew Carnegie, mesmerized by France's display of an enormous collection of French medieval monuments at the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago in 1893, decided to give his hometown a museum of the best monuments in the world, the competition was not exactly welcomed in New York, and all the works had to be ordered from Europe. Made on high speed, this collection was instantly deemed a ready-made, a compilation of whatever was available in the European cast market. This ready-made quality is exactly what makes this collection so compelling. But after all, the critique was a bit unfair. Carnegie, whose wealth and power was at the time almost unparalleled globally, wanted something absolutely spectacular, most probably to overtrump the arrogant New Yorkers. By the assistance of the American Secretary of State, three ambassadors, and interference on all levels of French politics, from the cabinet, the preservation authorities, to various local mayors, Carnegie bribed and threatened his way around French monument legislation, and indeed managed to have produced a one-of-a-kind sensation. The full front of the 12th century Abbey Church Saint-Gilles-de-Gare became the most expensive cast in the world. The monument was made by some of the best French molders, who also spent months in Pittsburgh in 1906 to build what had arrived with four steamers, and in 200 crates, shipped from Marseille to New York and brought by train to Pittsburgh. And as far as I have understood, the finishing of this cast was made by encrusting local minerals in the surface, adding a surprising site specificity to the work. And this is the drawing for the construction of the cast. It is quite amazing. As temporary venues for Room 101, an untitled domestic, these splendid courts and contexts also display the immense work and determined passion involved in the making of these predecessors of White Reed's no less impressive negative spaces in plaster and concrete, also craft-wise. Other echoes between these two worlds might be encircled in issues of absence and presence, as well as of destruction and production. Something that is always felt in the presence of White Reed sculptures, the plaster monuments were once considered as a way more valuable way of presenting, documenting, and displaying architecture than photography. Three-dimensional and at full scale, they could be experienced bodily, spatially, and sensually. Their presence are immediate, something we can understand with our bodies, in movement, as spatial sequences, making the idea of a promenade in time and space prevalent. One important ambition was to allow the audiences to wander through architectural history at full scale, as a condensed grand tour. In the 19th century, the preoccupation with the history and historicity of the monuments of the world and the emphasis on sensation made the finishing of the exhibits critical. These collections were all about showing architecture from across time and place in one space, and to create architectural history in the gallery according to 19th century obsessions such as chronology, comparison, progress, and evolution. While architecture in the real world, of course, does not come in any particular order, perfectly installed plaster monuments could present different theories on history. And the plaster monument entrepreneurs displayed an intense interest in materiality. The techniques for surface treatment varied, and so did the ideals for the added patina. Thus, casts from the same series, made from the same mold, could achieve individual appearances in different museum settings, reflecting particular tastes and ideals, and sometimes accidents or misunderstandings. Questions of patina bristled with profound theoretical concerns insofar as the surface not only anchored the monument in time, but also prompted questions regarding the temporality of the plaster monument itself. Painted surfaces could, for instance, realize the assumed color schemes of ancient architecture. In the 10 architecture courts that opened in 1854 in the enlarged and relocated Crystal Palace at Sydenham, Owen Jones took the opportunity to test out theories of the color schemes of antique and medieval architecture. I'm quoting, "I felt that to color a Greek monument would be one of the most interesting problems I could undertake," Jones explained in an apology for coloring the Greek court. "Not indeed in the hope that I would be able completely to solve it, but that I might, at least by the experiment, remove the prejudice of many." Jones' experiment was not particularly successful. Basically, everybody hated it. But the painted Parthenon frieze and the lavish display in the Egyptian hall brought scholarly debates on polychromy to the attention of popular audiences. Unfortunately, photography turned Sydenham's colorful environment gray, but what you see in the background is Owen Jones' painted Parthenon frieze. Another take on presumed original states resulted in assemblies of pristine white casts announcing perfection as a property of the reproduction. The display of French architecture across a millennium at the Musée de Sculpture Comparée in Paris aimed at giving disparate objects a unified appearance, facilitating formal comparison of sculptural and structural traits. The monochrome surfaces unified the collection as well as the entire French tradition. While architecture patinates with moss and pollution through natural disasters, war, terror, use, and restoration. The reproductions in their museum habitat were envisioned not to patinate, and to be, in fact, more authentic than the works they depicted. In this collection, which I will return to, the monuments were presented in plaster perfection in a fascinating ahistorical debate on history. A third strategy was to imitate the current state of the weathered originals. This as-is method seems straightforward and perhaps obvious. It did, though, result in unexpected deviations of the cast and the monuments it was meant to represent. Not only the Elgin marbles turned black after a couple of decades in the London smog, but both marbles and cast turned increasingly grayish black during a century when most museums were heated by coal. Anyway, the passion for truthful presentation was at the core of all of these different takes on patina and surface, authenticity and history, bespeaking both idealized origins and deteriorating presences. The topic of destruction works on several levels. Many casts were made to document disappearing monuments, similar to how digital recordings of fragile structures work today, making the 19th century cast an important, if partly overlooked, part of preservation history. While collecting marble fragments at the Acropolis, Lord Elgin also had lots of casts made of the Parthenon frieze. The Elgin marbles and these casts were always shown together in the British Museum across the 19th century. When in 1929, the Illustrated London News published The Parthenon Frieze, Effects of a Century of Decay, new shots of the frieze in Athens were juxtaposed with the British Museum's casts made in 1802. The photographs documented drastic corrosion and revealed, as we can read here, how much the sculptures have suffered in the intervening period, thus showcasing the intricate relation between ever-changing originals and their serialized reproductions. Less than a decade later, the art dealer Joseph Devine ordered the surfaces of the Parthenon fragments restored to a classicist white when installed in the Devine Gallery. This led, well known, to a cleansing process that forever changed their patina and erased the last evidence of the once polychrome frieze. Another radical part of this story is the destruction of the casts themselves. The reasons for dismantling these collections were various and local. The architecture courts at Sydenham burned twice. The galleries were restored after the first fire, but in 1930, the whole Crystal Palace burned to the ground. Yet overall, displays of plaster became an intellectual and artistic embarrassment in modernist culture, and the casts were over a few decades subjected to deaccessioning, neglect, denial, and violent destruction on both sides of the Atlantic. A late occurrence in this history of destruction happened in Paris in May 1968, when the monuments in the Cour Vitrée at the École des Beaux-Arts were attacked by students as symbols of repressive teaching systems. Among the monuments salvaged from the riots was the colossal ruin of the Temple of Castor and Pollux from the Roman Forum, erected under Félix Duban's glass-covered courtyard from the 1870s and displayed together with the full-scale northwestern corner of the Parthenon. By the efforts of three Prix de Rome winners and the two molders that in the 1850s had patented the new technique that allowed for bigger and lighter casts, the students would have the noblest monument of the Corinthian order around every day. It was, however, also envisioned as a salvage operation, While working on this French version, hyper-styled and restored to a fictitious pristine state, the makers of the Roman monument in Paris declared a little ode to the ex situ experience of antiquity. Eventually, they said, the marble fragments in Rome would be scattered on the Forum, exposed to impious travelers' hammers. But soon the École des Beaux-Arts will fully have recovered these columns. One will have to go to Paris to study one of the most beautiful ancient Roman monuments. Rebuilt in Versailles in 1976, a century after its first erection in Paris, it testifies to the history of construction, destruction, and reconstruction at work in the world of plaster architecture. To me, this allegorical dimension of invention and destruction might be encircled in the unforeseen constellation of cast concrete and plaster casts that took place in New Haven in 1963, with the inauguration of Paul Rudolph's Arts and Architecture building at Yale University. The Yale School of Fine Arts, the oldest art school in an American university, lent not only its name, but also its curriculum from the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris. The school collected casts since the 1860s, exquisite, incredibly rare and expensive high-end productions. They were made by the most distinguished European formatori from the originals and were thus authorized, authored, and authentic works. When Joseph Albers left Black Mountain College to become the chair of the newly established Department of Design at Yale in 1950, his mission was to bring modernism to Yale, as the dean put it, to dust off the Beaux-Arts cobwebs and introduce Bauhaus teaching methods. The first thing Albers did upon arrival was to get rid of the casts, and in a very literal sense, I found eyewitness testimonies in Yale archives from colleagues that saw Albers throwing the casts out on the street. The surprise here is, however, not so much that it was the Bauhaus teacher and artist Joseph Albers who became the nemesis of the Yale collection, but that the both Beaux-Arts and Harvard-trained architect Paul Rudolph, he studied with Walter Gropius at the GSD in the 1940s, reinstalled these Beaux-Arts relics in a building that would become a masterpiece of American brutalism. While designing the art and architecture building, characterized by its corrugated concrete walls, Rudolph came across 200 casts in the basement of the school's former premises that Albers had forgotten to destroy. He mounted them across the 9 floors and 37 levels of the new school, creating unexpected vistas, sensual surprise, bodily experience, vast spaces, intimate moments, labyrinthine circulation, and dramatic juxtaposition. Rudolph completely repurposed these objets trouvés that were once used to teach the history of art and architecture as chronology, evolution, and style. His installation was polychronic rather than chronologic, playing with time and temporalities. For instance, he fragmented a huge cast of a bas-relief from the female pharaoh of Hatshepsut's funerary temple in the Theban Acropolis that he found uncrated, and thus appeared as brand new as from a time capsule. One section was hung in the school's narrow stairwell, resurrected. This piece, stripped of its intended pedagogical purpose, point to what Rudolph firmly believed was lost with modernism. To me, this breathtakingly beautiful installation you see here and the other casts he eccentrically installed across the building also evokes the allegorical pulse Walter Benjamin found at work in the Baroque German Trauerspiel. As transient and profoundly historical objects, they are fragments of fragments, mutely pointing to lost context, worldviews, and systems of meaning, not unlike the bodies and almost in, un, intelligible objects and emblems that were spread across the scene at curtain fall in the obscure theater tradition Benjamin studied in the mid-1920s. Let me conclude with a bold reflection on the value of architectural reproductions that I believe captures aspects of both the 19th century casts and Rachel Whiteread's large-scale sculptures. It appears in a novel that was published just before the tide was turning against the plaster monuments, when most collections were channeled into storage and oblivion. Marcel Proust did not share his contemporaries' increasing distaste for plaster. My chapter 2 is entitled Trocadéro, Proust's Museum. I am, of course, talking about Viollet-le-Duc's museum, namely the Musée de Sculpture Comparée, open for the public at the Palais de Trocadéro in 1882. Viollet-le-Duc, the French Restoration architect, had been lobbying for a major museum of reproductions in Paris since the 1840s, and importantly, without the classical inclinations that governed the collection at the École des Beaux-Arts. Many of the enormous plaster monuments that were displayed chronologically in enfilade galleries arranged by centuries were made during Viollet-le-Duc's restorations of French medieval monuments, when the buildings were anyway draped in scaffolding. The museum's main purpose was to show the history of French monumental art in complete series as an evolutionary continuity that would reveal relations undetectable in the fragmented reality of the real world, perfectly mounted and under perfect light conditions. This museum was a radical project, also in the sense that its founders not only claimed that a perfect cast held the scientific value of the original work, but in fact was plus exact que l'original, more precise than the original, and closer to the monument of its in its making than the original work itself, that would always be corrupted by the ravages of time. Proust's observations of the value of a cast would certainly have pleased the architects, restorers, artists, molders, directors, curators, archivists, and photographers involved in what became one of the most influential collections of plaster monuments. Obviously, Marcel Proust himself, the author, was intimately familiar with the museum, which was a major Parisian attraction in the last decades of the 19th century. Read biographically, it is everything but a wild guess that Marcel Proust himself, as a young boy, visited the fashionable Trocadéro. Everybody did that. This photo shows a young boy, Marcel's age, in the novel, admiring one of these plaster portals at the Trocadéro about 10 years ago, when the collection was made part of the Cité du Patrimoine et d'Architecture, the new architecture museum in Paris in 2009. After decades in limbo, many of the pieces from the original collection were brought back to the galleries and exquisitely displayed. This one, for instance, is pulled out from the wall so that it's possible to inspect also the back of the cast and get some impression of how they were made with armatures in wood and metal. This is one of the galleries in which the young Marcel in the novel is admiring a specific plaster portal, one of the first objects of desire introduced in Proust's novel, and an object that captures with emblematic power the disappointment that governs the logic of desired played out in Proust's aesthetics. A particular portal at the Musée de Sculpture Comparée appears twice in Proust's novel, in two scenes separated by hundreds of pages and several volumes. The plaster portal from the medieval church in the fictitious Norman town Balbec. The protagonist narrator's mentor, the art collector Charles Swann, describes the church at Balbec as a medieval masterpiece, partly Romanesque, partly Norman Gothic, partly Persian. For the young Marcel, Swann's alluring evocation spurs a wild desire to see this extraordinary church firsthand, a longing cultivated for years when his grandmother finally takes him on his first of several trips to Baalbek for a summer holiday. However, finally in front of the church, in this long-awaited moment, Marcel unexpectedly finds himself desperately longing for the museum in Paris. In situ, he immediately realizes that the original does not measure up to the reproduction. Not only is the church trivialized by its surroundings, by prosaic elements such as a square, a cafe, a billiard saloon, a bank, a bus station, streetlights, and trams. While the gallery offered the perfect curatorial setting for the plaster portal, the deteriorating church is lost in context and smothered by its milieu, contaminated by smell, by natural uncontrolled light, by dirt, and also by its tangibility. Marcel expected the real church to be more imposing than the plaster monuments in Paris. It turns out to be much less, as Proust puts it. The church has absolutely nothing of the aura that is normally ascribed to the unique, the particular, the original. While the plaster portal in Paris appeared universal and immortal, endowed with a general existence and an inaccessible beauty, the stone version is the victim of time and reality, representing nothing but an oppressive tyrannie de particulier. In Proust, the encounter with the real thing becomes traumatic. Corrupted in both time and place, the original was nothing but a reduction in stone compared to the flawless plaster version with which the young Marcel had fallen in love. If the brutal collision of the real and the imagined is typical for Proust, the conflict between a deteriorating original outside curatorial control and a perfectly mounted reproduction mirrors in detail the historical, scientific, and aesthetic objectives of the Musée de Sculpture Comparée. Proust praised the timeless perfection of a plaster cast while deeming the real church reduced to nothing but its own shape in stone. This inversion of modern hierarchies of originals and copies is indeed imminent in Proust's aesthetics. Still, Proust shows that the monument's irreproducible particular does not reside in its material authenticity. Indeed, Proust's thinking on the reproduction challenges the notions of aura developed by his German translator, namely Walter Benjamin, inspired by the theories of origins and patina that were realized in the displays at the Trocadero. In the novel, the plaster reproduction presents the true essence of the building in a controlled curatorial environment, as the ideal way and place to see architecture as it ought to be perceived, without trivial circumstances interfering its perception. As Marcel would acknowledge in Baalbek, within the frames of a novel, a cast displayed under ideal conditions allowed for an in-depth analysis and the appreciation of details undisturbed by the trivialities of the real world. The remnants of 19th century caste culture interrogates concepts of originality, authenticity, and authorship, forcing a reconsideration of received ideas of monuments and permanence. The idea of the precious original, the tenacious cult of authenticity, the obsession with indigenous materiality, the modernist ideology of honesty, and essentialistic conceptions of site specificity are all challenged by the historical patina of the traveling monuments. The material banality of the plaster monument presents to us the enormous effort involved in their production as well as their profound historicity. I dare to claim that this applies to Rachel Whiteread's work as well, and that her architectural sculpture indeed makes us look differently at the world surrounding us, from the spectacular to the everyday. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.